Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that's Richard Swift, and it's a song called Wendy, which comes from his most recent album, the posthumous album called The Hex. And that song, Wendy, is by way tonight of introducing my guest. It's the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tunes. And tonight, picking the music, is Wendy Erskine, the writer of a very, very fine book called Sweet Home. And Wendy is with me in studio. I'm delighted to have you here, Wendy.
Delighted to be here, thank you.
You're on this programme not just on the basis of the book that you've written, but I saw a tweet one night on the Twitter sphere where you tweeted out a picture of a plate, and it was a bird's record.
Yes, that's right.
And I thought, there's someone's into the birds. I wonder what you do the show. It was as simple as that. And you're dressed, I mean, this is not television, but you're dressed tonight as if you could be in the birds. You're wearing one of those proper Western shirts.
I am, yes. I love Western wear. I think it looks very nice.
It does.
And I like painting a bird's plate now and again, sweetheart of the rodeo plate, I've got a chance to.
Well, you haven't disappointed. I'm just looking at the list now and it's all there, and I can't wait to hear all your choices. So thanks for coming in, Wendy.
You've travelled from
Belfast today, and maybe we'll just get into your very first choice.
Okay. My very first choice is Belfast, but not Belfast by Orbital. This is Belfast by Boney M.
Well, there you go. There's a first. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Wendy Erskine, the writer, is with me in studio tonight, and that is her first choice. That indeed is Boney M and Belfast. I remember that. What's your memory of hearing that for the first time? Because you are younger than me, but we're near enough vintage.
We are. I remember hearing that on, or seeing that on Top of the Pops, and it would have been about 1979. And I already liked the group because the first single I ever bought was Ma Baker, about the Chicago gangster family, and that was the first thing I bought. I'd loved that. And then I was watching the TV, and it was these, you know, wonderful looking individuals leaping up and down, singing in quite a, you know, serious way that Belfast, everybody was leaving. A final bell was being rung, a sort of dreadful apocalyptic scene. And I went running down to my mum in the kitchen to say, is it true, with people on the TV singing that everybody's leaving? All the children are leaving. The bell's been rung for the last time. We're all going. And my mum, I mean, in every single memory I have of my mum, she's, you know, of my childhood, she's standing at the sink doing the dishes, and she said, no, never worry about it, some other Belfast they're talking about.
I was never sure Boney M were singing about anything in particular, you know. I thought it was all nonsense, but looking back, like, there was some content to their work.
Well, there was some, yes. I mean, it certainly, I think they tried a few other cities beforehand.
Right.
Derry, I know they tried, but Derry doesn't scan as well. Beirut maybe might have been okay, I don't know. But Belfast is what they plumped for.
Oh, there you go. So that's one of your earliest musical memories.
Yes.
It is, and it's kind of odd when you hear, in your case, the place where you're from mentioned in a song at all, you know.
Yes.
The first time I heard Belfast mentioned in a song would have been Van, St Dominic's Preview.
And yes.
Of course, there have been a few other ones since. So you're from Belfast.
Yes.
And this is the thing, we touched on this just before we came in, Wendy. When I have a guest here on this programme, I ask all sorts of innocent questions. But when you ask somebody from the north, they're not innocent at all.
Mm-hmm.
When I say, what part of Belfast were you from? Whereas if I said, what part of Cork were you from? What part of Dublin were you from? So if I say, what part of Belfast are you from? That, if I asked you that question in a studio in Belfast, it would seem like the most pointed, loaded question in the world.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like asking people, what school did you go to?
Exactly, yeah.
You have an automatic signifier.
And we'll get to that as well. Yeah,
of class as well as, you know, background, yeah. Well, I'm actually from a place, Jordanstown, which is about 5 miles north of Belfast, really.
Yeah.
And it's quite sort of leafy suburbia with a university there. So, yeah, that's where I'm from.
Jordanstown. And sort of, was it, what kind of a household was it? What did your folks work at, or what happened there?
My dad worked in a bank,
and
my mum worked as a classroom assistant in a special needs school. And then I have one brother who's a couple of years younger than me.
And is that what you might have got from your mother, the educational approach? Because that's what you've been doing.
I work as a teacher. No, I mean, I suppose I had never any intention of going into teaching, really, whatsoever. It'd been something that I'd really not thought of at all. It was just then whenever I finished university, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I tried all sorts of different types of work, all sorts of different voluntary things, and some of them were sort of educationally based and enjoyed those, so that's what I ended up doing.
But and you went to university in Glasgow?
I went to university in Glasgow,
Was that, and you hear a lot about this now, that a lot of kids from Northern Ireland all head to Glasgow and places like that, you know, they just don't want to stay. Is that why you left, or was that just so happened that that's where you got in, or so?
Yeah, I went to Glasgow because I liked the music from. It was partly because I liked the music from Glasgow.
Yeah.
And also as well, there was a magazine, Just 17, and each week they had a different city, and there's photographs of the people from the city. And I remember just sitting with a big pile of these Just 17s, just looking through each of the cities whenever I was trying to decide where I might go to university. And I thought, yeah, these people in Glasgow look my type of people. This looks okay.
And what was the music you were drawn to in Glasgow?
I liked things like Orange Juice then, yeah. And I liked Jesus Mary Chain. I liked all of that kind of sort of C86 stuff, I suppose you would say.
And there were a lot of good clubs in Glasgow too.
Yes, and Glasgow's a great place to be.
What was that famous? Well, King Tut's, was it?
King Tut's. Now, that was, I was there a few years before that opened, but yes, St Vincent Street, yes, that was a great place.
Wow, okay. Your next choice, Wendy, is what?
My next choice is Love Reputation by Denise LaSalle.
Okay.
And Denise LaSalle died, it was maybe last year or the year before, and whenever the song they played to accompany, the news she died was that thing, Don't Mess With My Toot Toot, which was almost a novelty hit in the way that, it'd be like Chuck Berry, My Ding-a-ling. It's kind of in that.
That was my party piece, by the way, My Ding-a-ling. The idea that my parents would actually let me stand and sing that as an innocent child with no idea what I was singing about. Awful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's bad.
I digress. Yeah, Denise LaSalle.
But this is the first, this was her first single on Chess Records, Love Reputation.
And that's Denise LaSalle on Chess Records, song called A Love Reputation. It's the choice of Wendy Erskine, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. Wendy's book, Sweet Home, is to my mind, one of the best books of short stories I've read in a very, very long time. It's published by Sting and Fly. And we'll probably talk about them in a minute too, Wendy. But before I go any further, am I right in saying, I read this somewhere and I may be wrong, that the name Wendy is an invention of J.M. Barrie and Peter Pan? There were no Wendys before that?
So I've heard, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fictional character.
Character, absolutely. It's always seemed to me I know where it comes from, but it's still like a sort of a swinging 60s name, I think. Wendy. Well, it's a kind of dumbass name. In fact, it doesn't really mean anything whatsoever.
I mean, that book wasn't written all that long ago. Isn't it strange that it came from a novel and became a popular name?
Yeah. I mean, when I was in school, there would have been maybe three or four Wendys in my class, but I think have died out pretty much.
Wendy?
No.
Wendy Austin, do you remember on the radio?
On the radio? Yeah, Wendy Austin.
Yeah.
Wendy O'Williams.
That's right.
Plasmatics.
Yeah. And the other Wendy James.
Wendy James, yes.
They made that amazing record, all the songs written by Elvis Costello.
Yes.
It was an amazing record. Yeah. I'm not sure what he was playing out there, giving away all these fine songs, but anyway. You're from Jordanstown. Some people will know Jordanstown, I guess, now because of the university that's there and all the rest of it. And when you were a young kid at school, before you got to Jordanstown, were you the kind of kid in school thinking of what you've now become that was good at writing compositions and poems and little stories?
Yes, I always really enjoyed that. We had one teacher who, it was like a Thursday afternoon or something, and she would just devote the whole afternoon to sitting, writing a story. And she'd put something up on the board, it'd be a picture, or she'd maybe let us listen to some music, and you'd have the whole afternoon. And if you'd done a good story the previous week, you'd get a Mars bar to eat while you were, doing your writing.
And in those days, Mars bars were more substantial than they are now.
They were substantial, probably an inch, maybe longer. And it was just, to me, it was divine, you know. You were doing something really interesting, plus you were eating a Mars bar, and it was gorgeous. But parents all complained because, you know, if you didn't get the Mars bar, it was pretty rubbish sitting watching all these other people eat them. And also as well, some people thought that was just too much time to devote to sort of creative pursuits like that. So it was knocked on the head after a few months. But I absolutely loved that.
And, you know, were you the kind of kid who wrote mad fantastical tales? Or were you already the kind of kid who writes as you do now about real stuff, real people, real events?
No, I was never fantastical whatsoever. I was always very much in the mundane department. Even sort of music and stuff that I would have liked whenever I was pretty young, you know, it was always, like, say something like Squeeze, you know, stories of guys going through divorces. That was the type of thing that I quite liked.
At what age?
I liked Squeeze from when I was about 10, 11, 12 or so. I was always drawn to that quotidian type of world. It was never unicorns and, you know, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, those songs, it's, you know, Up the Junction and all those songs, they're not for 10-year-olds, you know?
Well,
maybe you were just advanced.
Advanced in the ways of the mundane. Maybe that was me,
So if you like Squeeze, then I'm guessing now that you possibly also liked Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and those sorts of guys, because they were all much the same bunch of people, really. They all worked with each other and produced each other's records. And all
I liked all of that. I liked Ian Dury as well.
Yeah, Stiff Records.
Yeah, Stiff Records, just generally. I liked, and Dr. Feelgood too.
Great.
Yeah.
And where did you find this music? Where did you hear it?
I still listen to the radio loads, but would have listened to the radio a lot. I also had an uncle who, both my mum and dad, no interest in music whatsoever, like, absolutely none, really. But I had an uncle who was very, very interested in music, was a real record collector, still is. And so would have heard bits and pieces as well from him.
All right, okay. Yeah. And what about playing music?
I would love to have played music, but I played the violin as a kid. I was absolutely awful at it, absolutely dreadful. And so I just presumed that had I, you know, picked up any other instrument, like, I don't know, bass or whatever, guitar, I would have been just as useless at it as I was at the violin. So I didn't play any music whatsoever.
Sound like you regret that a bit.
Do kind of regret it a bit. But I've got a daughter of 16, and she plays, she's out already playing places and so on. And she always says, you know, how could you have liked music so much but never bothered to try and, you know, do anything yourself? I said, well, I didn't know anybody, and, you know all these people and, you know, all the rest of it. And I think she thinks that's a bit feeble, really.
Yeah, but also, you know, as the song goes, different for girls. I mean, in those days, there were in certain places, clearly there were girls in bands, but I don't remember too many when I was growing up, girls in bands, particularly like that kind of, you might find a girl singing in a band.
Yeah.
But not too many girls with guitars.
I think that's very true. And I think even when I look back, even going into record shops, as being like 12 or 13 or 14, it's okay if you go into the record department in Woolworths, where it's very sort of communal or whatever. But, you know, going to record shops as well, it was a funny type of a place, you know, a gang of old sort of Clash fans down the bottom. It really isn't the most welcoming place for, you know, 12 or 13 year old.
Or in Belfast, gangs of heavy metal fans down the corner as well.
Yes, exactly.
You know? A lot of that. Yeah, and old punks.
And old punks,
Not necessarily an attractive prospect for a teenage girl to be hanging around in there. No, not really. All right, your next choice is what?
My next choice is actually from whenever I did work in a record shop myself.
Which one did you work in?
Making Tracks, it was called.
Were there two of them?
There were a couple, yeah.
Which one did you work in?
The one that I worked in was in... Castle Street.
Yeah. And the other one was the one where I remember U2 coming along there one night when Joshua Tree was released.
That's right.
Sign the record.
That's right.
Stuff like that. I bought many a record in Making Tracks, I must say.
The green and blue bag.
That's right.
It was a white bag with green and blue on it. Yeah.
Making Tracks. It's all coming back to me now. When were you working there, by the way?
Would have been about on and off from 86 to about 88 or so.
Wow, there you go. So what's the record then? What is it?
So the record is Male Stripper by Man to Man Meets Man Parish. And the record shop that I worked in sold a lot of it was quite a lot of heavy metal. But this record was very, very popular. But even at that time, people didn't want to come in and ask for it. People asked very surreptitiously for this record, and if it could have been put in a brown paper bag, it would have for some individuals.
Those were different days.
Different days.
And that's Man to Man meets Man Parish. The choice of Wendy Erskine is with me in studio. A track called Male Stripper. When working, when you were working in the record store, in making tracks in Castle Street in Belfast. Belfast, I remember there was a, you know, even in, you know, when times were bad and all, there was serious music feel about the place. A lot of people were seriously into music. All those record shops you're talking about were constantly full of people.
Yes, they were constantly full of people, and there could be really quite exciting places to be as well on a, you know, on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. And also that, you know, even before that, you mentioned your uncle was a record collector. There were people even before him and way back. You know, Van would often talk about Sally Lipset's shop and all. There were always little centres of civilization around the city. You know, these record stores were served an important purpose, I guess. And when you weren't working in the record store, were you in other record shops buying things?
Yes, it would have been in other record shops buying things, but I probably would have been in plenty of shops buying all sorts of things. I just like stuff generally, so yeah.
And when you started buying your own records, what would they have been? And I don't mean that you mentioned Boney M earlier, but when you get past that kind of, you know, childhood stuff of What's on Top of the Pops and so on, music that you felt was your own music.
Yeah. Well, I suppose there would have been, sometimes I would have gone to Good Vibrations and they would have sold these. They were almost like sort of lucky bags of 7-inch singles that they might have had around the shop for, I don't know, even quite a few years. Yeah. And that was quite an exciting thing.
Yeah.
I remember getting one and it had a great song, a great single, Spitfire Boys, Fun Time, which was like this 1979 sort of post-punk group from Liverpool. It was absolutely brilliant. And then there was another one. It was like a fold-out. It was like Making Plans for Nigel, XTC. So that was in the same bag. And it had this little game that came with it, like Snakes and Ladders. So it could be Nigel versus his parents, who was going to win out in terms of the game of life or whatever. The first album I would have bought would have been Squeeze. It was like a sort of a Squeeze compilation singles, 45s and unders. That was the first album I remember buying.
And did you, because I just know looking at your list, you obviously took it a whole lot further. Were you reading the music magazines or were you reading books about the history of pop music or was someone giving you some instruction on the side or what was happening?
Yes, I still do. I love music books. I love music magazines. So I would have bought, would have started off with Smash Hits and Number One. Mm. Sometimes Record Mirror, but Record Mirror was more lists I found. And then I would have graduated on to the NME. Occasionally would have read Sounds, but it would have been mainly NME. But there were lots of books as well. That I was reading. Always liked reading lots of stuff about the Rolling Stones. I've always just really enjoyed reading books about music.
You can get lost in the history when you do that too, and it's a great way of opening it up because you start to connect things.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
What connects with what and what was around at the same time is, you know, sometimes it needs the expertise of a book to kind of sort out what's swirling in your head.
Yes, and often as well to read sort of behind the myth of some of these things, you know, to look at how much waiting around there is and how boring it can be at times. Uh-huh. You know, like it's a book I love, Nicky Hopkins by Julian Dawson. And it's brilliant. You know, Nicky Hopkins' experience as a session pianist for the Stones is just really very interesting.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it sound terribly exciting a lot of the time.
And speaking of myths, Velvet Underground
yes.
is your next choice. When did you first hear the Velvet Underground? Because that's a step up from the pop music a lot of us might have heard to suddenly hearing this kind of darker, more serious, challenging kind of music in a way.
Yeah, I suppose by the time I was about 15 or 16, I would have been listening lots to the radio again in the evenings, would have been listening to John Peel or, you know, whatever else was on. And so I probably would have liked the Velvet Underground from I was about 16 or 17. And then I moved to Glasgow, where it was nearly obligatory for everybody to love the Velvet Underground and to wear a stripy top and pointed boots. So I really got into them then. But my choice here is probably from, you know, for Velvet Underground aficionados, this is probably not the most obvious album to choose because it's the most commercial one, loaded and loaded with hits. They're hoping anyway. It's Oh Sweet Nothing.
Oh Sweet Nothing. That's the Velvet Underground, and it's the choice of Wendy Erskine, who's with me in studio. Of course, they could write pop songs.
They could write pop songs. I think this whole album, I mean, you can see his sort of brill building.
Yeah.
Training coming to the fore there, I think.
Did you ever hear that song, The Ostrich, did you? That was the first song he wrote. It's one of those kind of gimmicky bubblegum pop songs called The Ostrich. Every other bird, I think, had been taken up the title. But yeah, he could write. And in fact, in nearly any Velvet Underground song, there's always at least one beautiful ballad, slow ballad pop song. There's a Perfect Day on every album, you know, one of those ones. Yeah. So you're into the Velvet Underground, and you were saying that in Glasgow, in particular, it was almost obligatory to be an underground fan. What was all that about?
I think in Glasgow at that time, there was a lot of interest in 1960s music generally, 1960s sort of psychedelia, garage music, sort of freak beat music. That was really, really popular. Yeah. Well, the people I knew anyway at that particular time.
Now, you mentioned the 60s, and Belfast played its part in the 1960s in particular. Some extraordinary music came out of it. I mean, there's a story in your book about a musician, right? I want to get the title correct. Yeah, 77 pop facts you didn't know about Gil Courtney. And I was thinking to myself, I've never heard of this Gil Courtney guy. And I started to check just in case. But you made him up, obviously.
Yeah, he's made up, yeah.
But it would be entirely believable because there was David McWilliams, who you mentioned in the story. Mm-hmm. And obviously there was Van Morrison and there was, you know, Eric Bell. And there were others who kind of were just on a level slightly below Van, who might have broken through, like Sam Mahood and all. There were loads of people knocking around Belfast in particular, and people like Rory then went to Belfast to be around that scene, you know.
Yeah.
Were you conscious of that growing up, or was it something you would have found out about after the event?
I suppose, I would sometimes have gone to hear, even like Sam Mahood, say, even in like the 80s, did like New Year's Eve, you know, sort of soul night, the Ulster Hall. I would have gone to that, even in the sort of 80s. That would have
been amazing.
It was brilliant. Absolutely, absolutely fantastic. I suppose I would have been pretty aware that there'd been a lot of good groups that had played in Belfast, that like the Small Faces had played at the Floral Hall, and you know, that the Stones had played in Belfast.
Hendrix played
so
in the Elmwood Hall, right, did my exams.
Yeah.
You know, and Zeppelin played, you know, first Stairway to Heaven was in Belfast, apparently.
Yeah,
Those Belfast performers, like Sam Mahood and the rest of them, you know, if Van hadn't been around, one of them would have probably made it, you know. And a lot of those musicians were still knocking around.
Yeah.
People from who were in them, you'd see John Wilson and Billy Harrison and those sorts of guys playing around the place.
Yeah. I mean, generally it's just, I just find all of that pretty interesting as to why some people become successful and others don't. And, you know, I suppose that's what I was trying to look at in that story, Gil Courtney, that there's some people that just the stars were not aligned in their favour.
But I think some of them, you know, might have had talent and might have had, you know, you would imagine they had what it took, but there's always something else that it needs that most people don't have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any of those people we're talking about could have done what Van did. Mm-hmm. And he's still doing, actually. That's the thing. It's a special kind of person who has the stamina, even. Mm-hmm. Even the stamina to keep going.
Yeah.
But so many of those very fine musicians who David McWilliams, who you mentioned in the thing, you know, Days of
Pearly Spencer, yeah.
Super. And of course, and Henry McCullough. I don't know if you knew Henry, but I mean, Henry was, he lived in Enniskill and he was in a band called the Skyrockets. And then he would often join Wings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he played with Wings for years. But like Henry played with Hendrix and everybody, you know. It's just the most extraordinary thing, you know. But there we are. Belfast, eh? And then the other part of Belfast musical history that people dwell on quite a bit are the punk years.
Mm-hmm.
Did that mean anything to you? Because you would have been too young to be in the thick of it.
Yeah, I would have been too young to be in the thick of that. Yeah, I mean, I can remember seeing people and so on a Saturday in Cornmarket. It was quite exciting to go past people, yeah, and to see what they were looking like. But I wouldn't really have known at that point any of the groups as such. Mm. No.
And those Belfast groups in particular, there was Rudy. I thought they were the best of them, mm, and then was Protex were a good band, and Stiff Little Fingers probably the best known. And mm-hmm. Of course, the Undertones weren't from Belfast, but they're on the same mm-hmm. label. Would you have sort of taken an active interest in Belfast bands in particular?
Do you know what? I would have to say, I was even thinking about, you know, the music that I've thought of for today. I don't really think there's anything from Belfast, or even from Northern Ireland. To be honest, I wouldn't. And it's the same sort of thing as if people are asking me, do you read lots and lots of writers from Ireland? I'm more likely to want to read something that's beyond my own immediate, you know, experience.
Oh, I understand that, all right.
I suppose I would say that in terms of listening to music, I probably would have been more interested in listening to something that was from New York, or something that was, you know, from London or whatever.
No, that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. So your next choice is not anything from Good Vibrations, but you're into the art world of Wire.
Yes.
Where did you find them first?
I think I just started listening to Wire maybe when I was about 18 or 19, whenever I moved to Glasgow. Mm. Probably started listening to Wire round about then. You were saying about the plate I did, which was the Sweetheart of the Rodeo. I did the 154 album cover. I stuck plasticine in one of our tiles in our kitchen wall, in the shape of 154. Took a photograph of that, put it on Twitter, and that's got more likes and more interest than anything ever to do with my writing.
And they very much were an art group.
And they were an art group, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, even the cover of this one, you know, Pink Flag, that's a great cover as well.
Yeah, it's a fantastic cover. It's a fantastic cover. I love everything about Wire. I love the sort of discipline, the sort of brevity of it. I love the way I love their voices. I love the way they speak. The stories that I do, I've only really got a couple of characters that aren't from East Belfast, but the characters from England, I always have them sounding like, you know, Colin Newman or somebody from Wire. So you not do any other voice for an English person other than, you know, thanks very much, thanks for your time, you know. It's the only voice I can do for English.
It's all right, it's working, Wire. Don't change it. So what track do you want?
I like Fragile.
Okay. You're not wrong about brevity. That's Fragile from Wire from the album Pink Flag. Wendy Erskine with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. That was a very... In those days, of course, you could get 30 or 40 songs. There was 21 on that, actually, on the one album.
Mm-hmm.
Brevity. It always works. Speaking of brevity, now, short stories, Wendy. Tell me how you're... You said you wrote when you were a kid at school and you had a bit of a knack for it, possibly, at that. When did you start writing something where you thought, you know, this actually isn't bad, is there? Have you ever felt that?
Well, I moved to Newcastle upon Tyne and lived there for four years, about 1993, and I was just basically a hermit for most of the time that I lived there. And I wrote a novel, and it was absolutely awful. And I sent it off to a few places, and it got rejected. And my attitude was, "You're so right to reject it. It's awful, isn't it?" I totally agree.
What was it? Was it really awful? Now,
yeah. You know, it was still in the same ballpark of the type of thing I write now, but it was probably very sentimental and very, very cliché. So it was pretty awful, to be honest.
Do you know why you wrote it? What possessed you to sit down and write a novel? Because it's a big step.
Well, I suppose I thought I might be okay at this. I don't have too much else going on in my life, why don't I give this a go? Because I've got plenty of time on my hands. Mm. And that was it,
so
basically.
You weren't devastated by rejection?
No, I fully anticipated it because I had such a low opinion of it anyway.
Yeah,
and then I did nothing at all. Until about 2010, I wrote a blog for a while, only for a couple of years. But I suppose it was like a kind of a tentative step into doing a bit of writing. But it was very short little pieces of writing that were based on music, or else it was, you know, recreating album covers using bits and pieces I found around the house. It was that type of a kind of creative project. And then after that, I didn't do anything until 2015. And I was getting, I work as a teacher, and I had one afternoon a week off. And I thought, let's try and do something with this one afternoon other than sitting reading a mag and having a coffee somewhere. So I looked around for things to do, and I happened to see that the Stinging Fly were running a course on a Monday evening in Dublin, which meant that was perfect for me because it was a Monday afternoon that I was getting off work, so it meant I could come down to do it.
Yeah, well, you must have had some sense that this was worth pursuing, because even that, I mean, it's a commitment, you know, to take on a course, and you're going to have to travel to take it on. You must have had, I'm not saying ambition, but some sense that you wanted to take it further.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I kind of thought, I did always think, I wonder if I could be quite good at this if I gave it a go. But I would put that alongside a number of other things I thought I could maybe be quite good at. Maybe if I went to the gym frequently, I would be in quite good shape. Maybe if I read a newspaper frequently, I would know more about what was happening in the world. So there are any number of other things that I knew if I gave them a go, life would probably be a bit better for me. Yeah. So this was just the one that happened to win out on this occasion.
Now, there are all manner of writing courses out there, and mm-hmm. I'm sure some of them are brilliant, and I'm sure some of them are nonsense and people just throw their money away. It's hard, you know, you wouldn't mm-hmm. hard to know. Stinging Fly, of course, great reputation.
Yeah.
And many, many fine writers have gone through their hands. So how did that one work? What sort of a course was it, and how does a course work? Because you can't teach people to write.
Well, what happened?
Or can you?
I think you can. I think you can get people quite far along the road.
Yeah.
What happened with me was I had to write a story to try and get on the course, and I wrote a story quite quickly, sent that off, got on the course, and then we met up once a week for 6 months, 2-hour session, where it was sort of a rotation of people would share their work with others, and it was led by this guy called Sean O'Reilly.
Who's an excellent writer,
yeah. Absolutely.
Really is.
And the course, I mean, I got the train back home every Monday, and I couldn't even have read anything because my mind would just be buzzing with all the things that would people had said and, you know, what had gone on. It was absolutely fantastic.
I guess when some people say you can't teach people to write. I suppose what I mean is, if you couldn't have written in the first place, that course would have been no use to you. The point is, you already had something.
Yeah.
And that level of intensity, I can see how you would improve at a tremendous rate, actually, if you put that much effort into anything.
Yes, well, certainly, yes, it did improve. But I wasn't sort of thinking, you know, I'm going to achieve world domination through the short story or anything like that. I mean, my aims were really modest. I mean, and the course was really good because it kind of never focused on people getting published. It was always just, right, you want to do something? Well, let's see how you can do it a wee bit better than you're doing it at present.
Yeah. So how many months did you say it was? Six months.
Six months. Mm-hmm.
And is there a kind of a target to hit at the end of that, or is it just to complete the time?
There was no target really whatsoever.
Yeah.
It was just that you started off here. Let's hope at the end you're a bit better than you were at the beginning.
So how did you feel at the end of the course?
At the end of the course, I felt absolutely jubilant because I was getting a story published in the Stinging Fly magazine, which was something that I had never anticipated happening whatsoever.
Right.
So it was fantastic. But to be honest, even if nothing had happened as a result of that, I still would have thought it was time well spent.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting group of people discussing interesting stuff.
And had you read many short stories before that? Because there are a lot of people who read and maybe they just don't read short stories, you know, or they don't read poetry, or, you know, there's some aspect of it that they just kind of blank out.
Yeah.
Short story readers tend to be fairly obsessive about short stories.
Yes, I suppose I had read quite a lot of short stories just because I suppose I'd read. Reading's my thing, so I had read quite a lot of just stuff generally. So yeah, I had read quite a few short stories, but writing short stories had never overly appealed to me because the way people talked about it, and it was so sort of craft based, it was like people constructing these sort of like Fabergé eggs. Mm. It was like all this sort of silversmithing style, everything was buffed and polished, and you hear people saying about short stories, oh, pristine and perfect, and I thought, gosh, that just sounds too hard work. That sounds absolutely awful.
No fun at all.
And no fun whatsoever. And
especially if you like language, you know, and the whole point of the short story is you have to strip mm-hmm. it down to nothing almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of realised that, you know, there is that dimension to it, but, you know, you can do all sorts of things. There are no rules really, as long as whatever you do works within the context of that particular story. Mm. It's you can do what you wish really.
And did that thing about doing what you wish, did it take you a while to realise that? And the reason I ask is there are some stories, that, like for instance, the Gail Courtney one I mentioned, mm-hmm. is a series of facts. Mm-hmm. And you also wrote a story on based on instructions for, was it a dishwasher or a washing machine or something?
Yes, that? That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
You didn't even remember that story.
Yeah, yes, I've got that one. yeah, I mean, I suppose what I'm always trying to do is what's the best form possible for telling that particular story. And the Gil Courtney one had gone through all these different kinds of versions where it was from the mother's point of view, was from Gil's point of view, and none of them had really worked. So that had all sorts of different lives as previous incarnations of different narrators and all the rest of it. It just never really took off. And it was Sean O'Reilly, actually. He was saying, well, can you not think of some other way to do it that's more akin to the actual sort of milieu that the story is placed in, and that's where I come up with the pop facts idea.
Yeah. Well, then, how did it get from that to a beautiful and, I have to say, a very well received book? I mean,
thank you,
and deservedly so. I mean, I love it myself, but I mean, it's a well received, well reviewed book. So, how did it get from the end of the course, you're getting a story published, to you're getting a whole collection of them published?
Well, shortly after that story was published, I got an email from Declan Mead from The Stinging Fly to say, you know, on the basis of that story you've just had published, I'd be interested in the possibility of a collection with you. And it was very tentative. It wasn't like a sort of done deal at that stage. And when I got that, when I got that email, I mean, that was really, really thrilling because obviously, you know, I knew all about The Stinging Fly. I knew who they'd published before and how amazing this was to be contacted by Declan in that manner. But I also thought, right, well, don't mess this up, you know. So I had to send more work to him, and I was kind of quite nervous sending the next few stories because I realised at that stage he could still turn around and say, oh, do you know what, actually I've read a few more and
my hunch was wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, that would have been fine too. I could have coped with it, would have been okay. But you know, that was slightly nerve wracking. But so I sent him another couple of stories and he said he liked them. And then I just thought, right, this is my absolute big opportunity here. I just have to totally go for it, like, you know, Future Islands and, you know, Letterman or whatever. Just gonna have to go for it. And so that's what I did.
And at that point, did you have stories, bits of stories, notes for stories lying around in drawers and you were able to really focus on this, or did you sit down and write the book?
Yeah, I sat down and wrote the book. I had maybe two stories that I'd done on the course that I was able to use, right, and the rest of it I just sat down and wrote it and wrote a story a month pretty much for 12 months.
Wow. But you work as well?
But I work, yeah. I work as a teacher, yeah.
So when you've got a job and you want to write at the same time, that's tricky and complicated. So were you able to literally think, right, I've got a half day on such and such a day and I'm going to do it now?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. Yes, that was it. I don't find I'm any more efficient whenever I've got more time. So it was basically, you know, get on with it when you've got the chance to get on with it. It doesn't matter if there's people around talking about the football practice. It doesn't matter if people are, you know, clearing up the dinner dishes all around. You just sit down and get on with it and do whatever you need to do that particular day.
Good advice. Your next musical choice, Wendy, is what?
My next musical choice is Life's Greatest Fool by Gene Clark.
Ah, Gene Clark. Life's Greatest Fool, a song from Gene Clark, which is the choice of Wendy Erskine, the writer, who is with me tonight in studio picking all the music. We'll have more from Wendy after this break. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. Sunday night, the special where we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight is Wendy Erskine, the author of Sweet Home. Wendy, we were talking there about the short stories and you literally sat down to write the book. You had a couple there already. Did you have a notion about what you wanted to write about, if you know what I mean? There are lots of people out there, I think, who can write, but they don't feel they have anything particular to say or anything particular to write about. Did you have... manifesto is the wrong word, but did you have a kind of an area that you wanted to explore as opposed to just whatever comes up?
Yeah, I suppose I did. I mean, number one thing, I didn't want to write about anything that required research. because I thought my time's short. I don't want to, you know, do stuff where I have to find out about a political situation in Mozambique or something in the 70s or whatever. So I was really just going to use a few streets.
That's a pretty important point, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, because you could end up doing a year's research.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you didn't have the time, so
just
it focused.
Didn't have the time. Yeah. So it was going to focus just on a environment that I knew pretty well.
Right.
And I suppose beyond that, I knew that, I suppose it practically was a manifesto, I suppose, in the sense that I kind of knew that I didn't want to do something that was massively plot-driven, that this was going to come from the creation of characters and how these characters' lives panned out. I wasn't particularly interested in looking at people that were in the depths of despair or the people who were in the heights of, you know, ecstasy. Interested in people that are more or less stoically continuing on as best they can.
You said there you wanted to write about the place where you were from, and that's fine. That's a good thing to do, obviously. But you said you wanted to write about the place where you were from. Did you have an approach to that as well? Was there anything extra to that?
I suppose, you know, a lot of people have said about it. Some people have said about it, you know, East Belfast, this is presenting East Belfast to people in a way maybe they haven't seen it before. But the same token, I've had other people who have said, this essentially isn't about East Belfast at all. This could be absolutely anywhere, with the exclusion of maybe a few details. Yeah. This could be anywhere. It could be anywhere in, you know, anywhere in the UK.
Mm. And you don't labour details either. You know, you don't. The details are there.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm from there, I'll pick up stuff maybe somebody else mightn't pick up. I mean, I know what side of the fence a character comes from by the name you've given
them, or
something they say. But you're not hammering anything home here ever, I notice. You know, you don't. There's no big grand statements about who this person is or what they're about. You know, you pick this stuff up.
Yeah.
You just suss it out. But East Belfast's interesting because Van Morrison has represented East Belfast in a way that most people wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who aren't from East Belfast wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Wouldn't recognise,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And avoiding, did you deliberately avoid those signposts that you would get in any books that are set in Belfast about, well, I don't know if you've mentioned any paramilitary group by name. There's an RUC reservist at one point, but that's a kind of an added surprising detail which appeared at a certain stage, but you seem to have avoided particularly potentially heavy-handed signposting throughout.
Yes, I didn't sit down. It wasn't a sort of schematic that I sat down with a list of things, you know, these are things that I need to avoid. But yeah, absolutely, as I proceeded through, there would be certain things that I would just decide not to, not to put in.
Because some of them fire off a kind of a klaxon, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
I know what this, and then the reader assumes they know what it's about straight away.
Yes.
Yeah, and starts jumping to all sorts of conclusions. And
yeah, exactly.
Starts finishing the story before you have.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Olga McClure.
Yeah.
Olga McClure is a school teacher in this. I got very fond of her. even though Olga McClure is not fully in the swing of things with the peace process. Not entirely. But you're a school teacher, and there's a lot of details in that story in particular that must come from your own experiences as a teacher. One of the things Olga does mentions is that there isn't a single pupil she's ever had that she didn't hit just a little. Would you confess to such a thing yourself?
No, I would not. No. I would say, I was interested in writing about somebody like Olga McClure because the notion, the stereotypical idea of the primary school teacher is the sort of this lovely, kind, benevolent individual who loves caring for young children and extracts joy.
She's a bit of a wagon, this one.
Whereas she's not like that. She's not like that at all. Whereas, no, I would have to say that the people that I've taught I've liked, you know.
And what about the there's a bit in that story as well about how the kids react to her. So, you know, she's walking along the street and they're there and she's noting that they're all wearing hot pants and they're checking themselves out and all this kind of stuff. And they think they've invented all of this and stuff about love bites and everything else. And the kids, of course, and it's understandable that kids that age would assume that the teacher has had no life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, I mean, I think that's absolutely the way it is. And it's also that way, I think, with parents and children too.
Yeah, just as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That woman, Olga McClure, was kind of based on somebody I once knew. Just had a brief conversation with them, and they had they'd been living in New York, you know, in the 30s and 40s, and had a very, very exciting life. But they were now really pretty old, and they went to the hairdressers, and they were totally dismissed by the people in the hairdressers as a, you know, pain of an old woman. Yeah. And yet these hairdressers, you know, their lives would have been infinitely less interesting, I think, than this woman's. Yeah. But she was just an old lady to them.
Yeah.
So that was supposed to
be. That's a good one. I think that's my favourite story in the book. But then the changes as time goes on. No, let's have your next choice, which is what? Black Seal.
Black Seal.
All right. Okay. Tell me about Black Seal. And here we go again. Chastity Belt.
Okay. Black Seal, Chastity Belt. Chastity Belt are a girl group, woman group, maybe we should say, from Seattle. And what I kind of like about them is that they all have jobs as well as producing this great music. And I think this is a beautiful song. I think there's something really sort of magisterial about it. And one of the characters in one of the stories in the book is called Black Seal. And so I basically got the idea from the character from listening to this song.
Would that happen a lot with you? Something coming from it, a song?
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
We'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
There you go, and that's Chastity Belt and Black Seal, the choice of Wendy Erskine is with me in studio. Now, you mentioned Black Seal as being the name of a character.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the Inakin story.
Yeah.
Now, would you often find, if not inspiration, at least a jumping off point in a song for a story?
Yes, I would. I mean, I tend to never really ever listen to music whenever I'm writing.
Yeah.
But it would be that now and again, a song would be something that would maybe trigger a particular type of character for me.
Right.
So say, for example, the one we played earlier, the Love Reputation, it definitely leads into the character Kim Castles from the song, from the story Observation.
Yeah.
So that would be one, that would be a connection there.
And what about mood? Would the song create the mood for a story, do you think?
Maybe
not a 3-minute pop song as opposed to listening to jazz in the background.
Yeah, sometimes, the sort of music that I'll listen to whenever I am writing would be something that would be much more mood-based. So it might be something like the Dirty Three. Normally stuff that doesn't have any lyrics, actually. So it'd be maybe the Dirty Three, or it might be something like the Necks, or it might be something like that group Endless Boogie, which
you need to get a guitar, you know. You really do need to get yourself a guitar. Very definitely. Because I was waiting for you to say, you know, some kind of a, you know, ambient electronica or something, but no, Dirty Three.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Bit of that violin.
That's it.
I should resurrect the old violin.
That could be it, That could be it. Now, you were talking about how you write these stories, and you've benefited from the fact that you've had limited time. So mm-hmm. you've had to knuckle down, mm-hmm. write them. Do you then, when it comes to revising and revising and revising, is that also an advantage? Because you could tinker with a story for so long, you know, that you could ruin it. But at the same time, it has to be polished, and it has to be revised. Do you think the lack of time is a good thing or a bad thing in that regard? Editing.
I think Those stories have gone through a lot of edits, and I think that they needed to go through a lot of edits. Could they have gone through even more? I'm not sure. Maybe not. I mean, I'm always just trying to cut away as much as possible. I'm nearly always trying to start the story further in than I originally did. There's nearly always too much.
So you might lop off the first page,
off the first page,
wow.
I think that advice people are told about, you know, that you need to have this superb introduction, you know, it needs to be standout. I think that's bad advice.
That superb introduction has probably been in your head for about 10 years.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you don't know where to go next.
I know, totally. It's like somebody coming into a room and going, ta-da, it's me.
Yeah.
Who's that?
Yeah, get rid of that.
Get rid of them.
Yeah.
Get rid of that introduction.
Wow. Yeah. And well, you know, you're a teacher, and we all know how demanding, it seems to be more demanding now than ever, because there's a lot of stuff that's not even to do with teaching that you have to do. Now, I don't, I'm not giving you the opportunity here, nor do I want you to diss your job or your pupils or any of the rest of it. But surely you're sitting there in the classroom thinking, I'd love to be at home finishing that story I started last night, you know? Or can you switch off?
I can switch off okay. I can honestly switch off okay. It's a lovely thing to come back to and enter into the world of a story. But I honestly would have to say that I do really enjoy the job that I do.
Yeah.
And it's very, very different to writing in the sense that it's very collaborative. So, you know, you're a group of people that are working basically for the benefit of another group of people. And I always wanted to do a job like that. I always wanted to do a job that sounds sort of tediously worthy. I wanted to do a job that was going to benefit people in some way. But I did want to do something like that. And so therefore, it's very different to writing, where it is a lot to do with the individual, and it is a lot to do with the individual's view and the individual's kind of ego. So I kind of quite like the work environment, which is about collaboration.
And when you talked earlier about being on the course, the writing course that you did, and you know, you talked about being in that kind of milieu would really get you going to write, you know, it would encourage you to write, talking about it and so on. In being in a classroom with bunches of kids and, you know, the racket and the chaos and the fun and all the rest of it, is that the sort of thing that stimulates the brain in the same sort of a way that, you know, that you're in the form for writing because you're in that environment? Or does it actually work against it?
I think it's just something totally different. You know, whenever I would be working in school, it's going to be, it's got very, very little crossover whatsoever.
Yeah.
And most of it is quite, what I'm doing in school most of the time is quite kind of analytical work. And it's very, very rarely about
You're an English teacher,
right?
And
yeah.
You're head of English. At some, where is it?
It's a school called Strathearn in East Belfast,
right.
So it's mostly analytical work, and it's mostly work as well that involves sort of the pupil voice as opposed to me. So I suppose best lessons are ones where I'm in almost in the background and it's kids discussing things or debating things. But I mean, I do really enjoy it as a job because I think I've never really forgotten what it feels like to be a teenager.
Yeah.
And I genuinely do find teenagers pretty interesting in terms of what they've got to say.
I think that's what I was trying to say, you know, unless you're one of those sort of deadbeat teachers and maybe they don't exist anymore. It would be, I'd imagine it'd be fairly stimulating mentally to be around kids that age who are talking about ideas and talking about books and talking about what they think something means and all the rest of it, you know.
In that respect it is. Yeah.
Okay, your next... anyway, listen, the point is you love the teaching, clearly.
I do, yes.
And you're not in that situation that so many writers are where they would love... dearly, dearly love to dump the day job so they could write all day long. Mm-hmm. It's a fantasy for most people, and they probably couldn't do it anyway. But you know, that's, you're not in that situation, which is kind of liberating for you, I suspect.
It is kind of liberating. It is. It's really pretty nice. It's a good situation to be in, I think. Yeah.
Next choice, Buck Owens.
Next choice is Buck Owens.
I love this song. I love this song.
It's a lovely song, isn't it? Brilliant. Yeah. Suppose. Country music is, whenever I was growing up, country music was massive, still is, in Northern Ireland. But I always regarded it as a totally sort of disassociative type of thing. You know, it was just like, oh, that awful stuff that's on the radio, and it was like so uncool. And then I suppose as I got older and, you know, started listening to Graham Parsons and all the rest of it, kind of thought this is...
Yeah, but you weren't hearing him on the radio.
Wasn't hearing him on the radio, but it was realising that there's types of country music there that are absolutely brilliant. And then you start listening to that and that leads you into other things. And my husband plays in a kind of a country sort of rockabilly band, and this is one of the songs that they do, A11, and it's probably one of the favourite ones.
This is Buck Owens. I don't know you from Adam. A11. Please don't play A11. That version from Buck Owens, the choice of Wendy Erskine, is with me in studio tonight. Big country fan. She's wearing the country shirt as well. So, what were we talking about? Yeah, we're talking about the teaching and that you know, you have no desire to give it up so you could write full time. But on the back of this book now, there's a lot of, this book has been really well received. I know a lot of people who have written books of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that book comes out and it's well received, there's people on their case saying you have to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting any pressure to write a novel?
Well, yeah, people do say that. People do say,
like, it's something better.
Yeah, a sort of an apprenticeship of short stories. That was all very well.
If only they knew.
You know, are you going to play with the big boys now?
Yeah.
And write a novel? And I've got a bit of an idea, and I've written a little bit, but I've also written as well some more stories.
Yeah.
But for me, it's not like I've got some, you know, massive big sort of signing, and, you know, I have to produce all these things. I don't really. I can just do what I want, really.
Yeah.
So, well, a present, I suppose, for me, people have asked me to do all different sorts of things. So I'm doing wee bits of writing here and there, which is pretty enjoyable, quite fun. But I haven't really worked massively on any big project for any length of time recently.
But that thing about short stories being perceived by some mm-hmm. as somehow lesser.
Yeah.
Because they're short.
Yeah.
It's such nonsense, isn't it? Because it's far harder to write a tight short story than a big rambling 25,000 word novel.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that book, to me, writing a novel, in some ways, I would think it would be in some respects easier, because you can enter into that world and you can remain in that world for however long it takes. Whereas
you need to be sure you want to remain in it, and your reader will want to remain in it for that length of time.
Well, maybe not. See how it goes. It might be a total flop and they'll want out of it within 10 pages.
Put Olga McClure in it, whatever you do.
But, you know, something like, you know, that Sweet Home, in some ways, even though the worlds of those stories are all pretty much within the same few streets, it's quite exhausting to kind of then have to create a new one. That whenever you're starting a new story, you're basically starting from scratch with a construction of a whole new universe, really. And I know it sounds preposterous to, you know, some guy maybe that's working on a building site to say, oh, it's exhausting constructing new, you know, fictional worlds. It sounds ludicrous, but it kind of is in its own way.
Mm. Do you find it exhausting? Stamina seems to be a big issue for a lot of writers.
Yeah, it can be quite exhausting.
Like, I mean physically.
Yeah, it can be quite physically.
I mean, obviously there's mental exhaustion involved in anything like that, but physically tiring and exhausting as
well. Yes, it is. It is, yeah.
And when you, of course, you work differently because you have limited time, so you have to grab it. But when you do sit down, how long would you be there for before you'd get up again?
I would try to do maybe about 1,000 words. So it would really be, rather than time, it would actually be number of words.
Okay.
So sometimes I can do that in a couple of hours. Sometimes it might take longer.
And if you found yourself ever sitting there for 3 hours and writing 5 words, no words?
No, I found myself writing, getting the right number of words, but them nearly all being absolutely awful. So if you
they're
deleted
just in
all
the
rubbish,
they're just in the wrong order, that's
five.
All.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, your next choice is Endless Boogie. This is long, so we'll not be playing all of it. But tell me a little bit about this one.
So this is a group from Brooklyn. They're quite old guys, if I'm sure you wouldn't mind me saying. It's Boogie. It's named after a John Lee Hooker song. And what their name. And what they do is, it's quite long sort of jams. Now, I love very traditional, old-fashioned, but I love that type of boogie sound. I could listen to ZZ Top and Status Quo or whatever ad nauseum. I really could. And so something like this, which just continues, is sort of, I don't know, there's a sort of a can quality to it as well, the sort of repetition. I just find it very, very enjoyable.
It's not often you get can and Status Quo mentioned in the same sentence.
Have a listen and see what you think.
Here it comes. I was indeed, Wendy, getting lost in that that jam, which goes on for another 6 minutes.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
And you're right, it even though it is, it's got that boogie thing going on, it sounds like can, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't
as well.
It?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a good one. And so that's Endless Boogie and On Cryology. I want to just go straight in and play some more music. What about, you want some Carl Perkins? And what do you want from Carl Perkins?
From Carl Perkins, Matchbox.
Let It Loose, Rolling Stones. Before that, Carl Perkins and a song called Matchbox. The choices of Wendy Erskine, who's with me in the studio. Wendy, we were talking about the rockabilly thing there when Carl Perkins was on. There was, when I was in Belfast, there was a bit of a rockabilly scene. Are there scenes in Belfast now, or has it become? Because it was on Belfast in those days. It was under pressure, obviously, but great stuff came out underneath or through that pressure, I suppose. But I wonder nowadays that things are a bit more normal and like everywhere else. Has Belfast become like everywhere else? I mean, are there kind of interesting bunches of people in their different tribes?
Well, I imagine there probably are endless bunches of interesting people, but you're probably asking the wrong person.
You're
because
corrected.
I'm a 50-year-old woman who, on a Friday night, likes to listen to Exile on Main Street, have a few drinks and eat some nuts. So I am probably not the best person to ask. My life is fairly circumscribed, but I would say absolutely there'll be interesting people out there.
But you talked about, you know, when you were younger and you'd be in Corn Market or somewhere, you'd see the punks. And I remember those guys, you know, you'd see them standing around. And would you see that on the street now? Would you see lots of young rockabilly kids with tattoos? Would you see punks? Would you see goths? Would you see those sorts of, are they still around? Because, you know, the people who did that in those days, they were pretty hardcore. They were very committed.
Yes. I don't see people like that too much, but I'm only ever really in Belfast at about 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning to go to Marks and Spencer's to meet my mum for a coffee.
You're just not rock and roll
anymore.
I'm just
not rock and roll. All I do is occasionally dance around my kitchen to a few songs. But yeah, I mean, I can remember back to, say, for example, a club like The Plaza, which was just, you know, in the 80s, where it would be total commitment and it would be a club for absolutely everybody from every single youth culture all bunged into the one little room. And it was a very, very exciting place.
You should get out more, you know.
I should.
So should I. So, Lord, Can You Hear Me?
Yes.
That wasn't just an outburst. This is the name of the track, which we're about to play from Spaceman 3.
Yes, this is from Spaceman 3. I think of Jason Pierce, Spaceman 3, Spiritualized, as being a bit like a sort of Jane Austen of music, in the sense that, you know, Jane Austen had her just little couple of inches of ivory where she wrote about a very circumscribed group of things. And I think he or they're kind of like that too. It's heroin, God, and getting out of it. And that's really what we have here.
And that's Aretha Franklin there, and a song called Sister from Texas. And before that, Lord, Can You Hear Me from Spaceman 3, the choices of Wendy Erskine, who's been my guest tonight on Mystery Train, picking all the music. Wendy, I'm really delighted you were able to make the trip.
I loved it. It was brilliant
delighted.
Being here. Thank you.
I saw that bird's plate. I thought it should be on the show. So if anybody else wants to be on this program, send out a good tweet of something, some homemade rock and roll artifact. Do you do a lot of that, do you?
Yes, I have to make my own fun, whatever way I can. Yep.
Wendy, before you go, just to tell people that you will read your story to all their Jews from Sweet Home across the week of Monday to Friday from the 4th to the 8th of March as RT Radio.
Yes.
Book on One nightly at 11:20. So they will hear you read to all their Jews. The book Sweet Home is published by Sting and Fly. And it's a great book, and I highly recommend you go out and read it. Wendy, thanks for coming in, and all the best with the write.
Thank you so much. It's been a total pleasure.
And your last choice is?
My last choice is My Ship Is Coming In by the Walker Brothers. I love this because I get the very definite feeling his ship is not coming in.
And on that note, thanks, Wendy.
Thank you.